By the time the Iqbals got there, the place was lit with dozens of gas lamps, garden candles and nightlights. The front door and windows had been speedily reinforced with hardboard, and the garden trees had their branches roped together.
"It's all about preparation,"
announced Archie, opening the door to the desperate Iqbals and their armfuls of belongings, like a DIY king welcoming the dispossessed.
"I mean, you've got to protect your family, haven't you? Not that you failed in that department. You know what I mean. It's just the way I see it. It's me against the wind. If I've told you once, Iqbal, I've told you a million times, check the supporting walls. If they're not in tip-top condition, you're buggered, mate. You really are. And you've got to keep a pneumatic spanner in the house. Essential."
"That's fascinating, Archibald. May we come in?"
Archie stepped aside.
"Of course. Tell the truth, I was expecting you. You never did know a drill bit from a screw handle, Iqbal. Good with the theory, but never got the hang of the practicalities. Go on, up the stairs. Mind the nightlights."
"A good idea that, eh?"
"Hello, Alcee. You look lovely as ever." "Hello, mill boy, just scoundrel. So, Sam, out with it. What have you lost?"
Sam had sheepishly recounted the damage so far.
"Ah, now you see, that's not your glazing. That's fine. I put that in. It's the frames. Just ripped out of that crumbling wall, I bet."
Sam had grudgingly acknowledged this to be the case.
"There'll be worse to come, mark mine. Well, what's done is done. Clara and Irie are in the kitchen. We've got a Bunsen burner going, and grub's up in a minute."
"But what a bloody storm, eh? Phone's out. Electricity's out. Never seen the likes of it."
In the kitchen, a kind of artificial calm reigned. Clara was stirring some beans, quietly humming the tune to Buffalo Soldier. Irie was hunched over a notepad, writing her diary obsessively in the manner of 13-year-olds.
8:30 p.m. Milat just walked in. He's so gorgeous, but ultimately irritating. Tight jeans as usual. Doesn't look at me, as usual, except in a friendly way. I'm in love with a fool, stupid me. If only he had his brother's brains, oh well, blah, blah. I've got puppy love and puppy fat. Ah, oh, storm still crazy. Gotta go. We'll write later."
"All right," said Miller. "All right," said Irie. "Crazy, this, eh? Yeah, mental. Dad's having a fit. House is torn to shit.
Ditto. It's been madness around here, too."
"I'd like to know where you'd be without me, young lady," said Archie, banging another nail into some hardboard. "Best protected house in Wilston, this is. Can't hardly tell there's a storm going on from here."
"Yeah," said Millat, sneaking a final thrilling peek through the window at the apoplectic trees before Archie blocked out the sky entirely with wood and nails.
"That's the problem."
Samad clipped Millat round the ear.
"Don't you start in on the cheekiness. We know what we are doing. You forget Archibald and I have coped with extreme situations. Once you have fixed a 5-man tank in the middle of a battlefield, your life at risk at every turn, bullets whizzing inches from your arse while simultaneously capturing the enemy in the harshest possible conditions, let me be telling you, Hurricane is little tiny small fry. You could do a lot worse than..."
"Yes, yes. Very amusing, I'm sure," muttered Samad, as the two children and the two wives feigned narcolepsy.
"Who wants some of these beans? I'm dishing out."
"Someone tell a story," said Alsana.
"It's going to get also boring if we have to listen to old warhorse big mouths all night."
"Go on, Sam," said Archie with a wink. "Give us the one about Mangal Pandey. That's always good for a laugh."
A clamor of noes, mimed slitting of throats, and self-asphyxiation went round the assembled company.
"The story of Mangal Pandey," Samad protested, "is no laughing matter. He is the tickle in the sneeze.
He is why we are the way we are. The founder of modern India. The big historical cheese.
Alsana snorted.
Big fat nonsense.
Every fool knows Gandhiji is the big cheese, or Nehru, or maybe Akbar. But he was crook-backed and huge-nosed. I never liked him.
But damn it, don't talk nonsense, woman. What do you know about it? Fact is, it is simply a matter of market economy, publicity, movie rights. The question is, are the pretty men with the big white teeth willing to play you, etc.? Gandhi had Mr. Kingsley bully for him. But who will do Pandey, eh? Pandey's not pretty enough, is he? Too Indian looking, big nose, big eyebrows. That's why I am always having to tell you ingrates a thing or two about Mangal Pandey. Bottom line, if I don't, nobody will.
Look, said Milat, I'll do the short version. Great-grandfather,
your great-great-grandfather, stupid, corrected Alsana, whatever, decides to fuck the English.
Milat!
To rebel against the English. All on his Jack Jones, spliffed up to the eyeballs, tries to shoot his captain, misses, tries to shoot himself, misses, gets hung.
Hanged, said Clara absent-mindedly.
Hanged or hung?
I'll get the dictionary, said Archie,
laying down his hammer and climbing off the kitchen counter.
Whatever, end of story, boring.
And now a mammoth tree, the kind endemic to North London, the ones that sprout three smaller trees along the trunk before finally erupting into glorious greenery, city living for whole diaspora of magpie. A tree of this kind tore itself from the dog shit and the concrete, took one tottering step forward, swooned and collapsed. Through the guttering, through the double glazing, through the hardboard, knocked over a gas lamp and then landed in an absence that was Archie-shaped, for he had just left it. Archie was the first to leap into action, throwing a towel on the small fire, progressing along the cork kitchen tiles, while everyone else trembled and wept and checked each other for injury. Then Archie, visibly shaken by this blow to his DIY supremacy, reclaimed control over the elements, tying some of the branches with kitchen rags and ordering Millat and Irie to go around the house, putting out the gas lamps.
We don't want to burn ourselves to death now, do we? I better find some black plastic and gaffer tape. Do something about this.
Samad was incredulous.
Do something about it, Archibald? I fail to see how some gaffer tape will change the fact that there is half a tree in the kitchen.
Man, I'm terrified, stuttered Clara
after a few minutes' silence as the storm lulled.
The quiet is always a bad sign. My grandmother, God rest her, she always said that. The quiet is just God pausing to take a breath before he shouts all over again.
I think we should go into the other room.
That was the only tree on this side. Best day in here. Worst's done here.
Besides, said Archie, touching his wife's arm affectionately,
you Bowdens have seen worse than this. Your mother was born in a bloody earthquake, for Christ's sake. 1907. Kingston's fallen apart, and Hortense pops into the world. You wouldn't see a little storm like this worrying her. Tough as nails, that one.
Not toughness, said Clara quietly, standing up to look through the broken window at the chaos outside.
Luck. Luck and fate.
I suggest we pray,
said Samad, picking up his novelty Quran.
I suggest we acknowledge the might of the Creator, as he does his worst this evening.
Samad began flicking through and, finding what he wanted, brought it patrician-like under his wife's nose. But she slammed it shut and glared at him. Ungodly Alsana, who was yet a nifty hand with the word of God, good schooling, proper parents, oh yes, lacking nothing but the faith, prepared to do what she did only in emergency. Recite.
I do not serve what you worship, nor do you serve what I worship. I shall never serve what you worship, nor will you ever serve what I worship. You have your religion, and I have mine. Surah 109, Translation N.J. Dawood. Now, will someone, said Alsana, looking to Clara, please remind my husband that he is not Mr. Manilow, and he does not have the songs that make the whole world sing. He will whistle his tune, and I will whistle mine. Samad turned contemptuously from his wife and placed both hands rigidly on his book. Who will pray with me?
Sorry, Sam,
came a muffled voice. Archie had his head in the cupboard and was searching for the bin bags.
Not really my cup of tea either. Never been a church man. No offense.
5 more minutes passed without the wind. Then the quiet burst, and God shouted, just as Ambrosia Bowden had told her granddaughter he would. Thunder went over the house like a dying man's bile. Lightning followed like his final malediction, and Samad closed his eyes.
Irie! Millat!
Called Clara. Then Alsana. No answer. Standing bolt upright in the cupboard, smashing his head against the spice shelf, Archie said,
It's been 10 minutes. Oh, blimey. Where are the kids?
One kid was in Chittagong, being dared by a friend to take off his lungi and march through a renowned crocodile swamp. The other two had sneaked out of the house to feel the eye of the storm and were walking against the wind as if thigh-high in water. They waded into Wilsden Recreation Ground, where the following conversation took place.
This is incredible! Yeah? Mental? You're mental! What do you mean? I'm fine. No, you're not. You're always looking at me. And what were you writing? You're such a nerd. You're always writing. Nothing. Stuff, you know? Diary stuff. You've got the blatant hots for me. I can't hear you. Louder. The hots. Blatantly. You can hear me. I have not. You're an egomaniac. You want my ass. Don't be a wanker. Well, it's no good anyway. You're getting a bit big. I don't like big. You can't have me. I wouldn't want to, Mr. Egomaniac. Plus, imagine what our kids would look like. I think they'd look nice. Browny black, blacky brown, afro, flat nose, rabbit teeth and freckles. They'd be freaks. You can talk. I've seen that picture of your granddad, great-great-granddad. Massive nose, horrible eyebrows. That's an artist's impression, you chief. And they'd be crazy. He was crazy. Your whole family's crazy. It's genetic. Yeah, yeah, whatever. And for your information, I don't fancy you anyway. You've got a bent nose and you're trouble. Who wants trouble? Well, watch out, said Millat, leaning forward, colliding with some buck teeth, slipping a tongue in momentarily, and then pulling back. 'Cause that's all the trouble you're getting.
Millat spread his legs like Elvis and slapped his wallet down on the counter.
One for Bradford, yeah?
The ticket man put his tired face close up to the glass.
Are you asking me, young man, or telling me?
I just say, yeah? One for Bradford, yeah? You got some problem, yeah? Speak of that English? This is King's Cross, yeah? One for Bradford, innit?
Millat's crew, Rajik, Ranil, Dipesh, and Hifan, sniggered and shuffled behind him, joining in on the yes, like some kind of backing group.
Please.
Please what, yeah? One for Bradford, yeah, you get me? One for Bradford, chief.
And would that be a return for a child?
Yeah, man. I'm 15, yeah?
course I want to return. I've got a body to get back to, like everyone else.
That'll be £75 then, please.
This was met with displeasure by Millet and Millet's crew.
You what? Taking liberties? 70? Charm, man! That's moody. I ain't paying no £75.
Well, I'm afraid that's the price. Maybe next time you mug some poor old lady, said the ticket man, looking pointedly at the chunky gold that fell from Millet's ears, wrists, fingers, and from around his neck. You could stop in here first, before you get to the jewelry store.
Liberties, squealed Hifan. He's cussing you, yeah?
Confirmed Ranil.
You better tell him,
warned Rajik. Millet waited a minute. Timing was everything. Then he turned around, stuck his ass in the air, and farted long and loud in the ticket man's direction. The crew, on cue,
Somokami!
What did you call me, you? What did you say, you little bastards? Can't tell me in English. Have to talk your packy language.
Millet slammed his fist so hard on the glass that it reverberated down the boats to the ticket man down the other end selling tickets to Milton Keynes.
First, I'm not a packy, you ignorant fuck. And second, you don't need a translator, yeah? I'll give it to you straight. You're a fucking faggot, yeah? Queer boy, poofter, batty rider, shit dick.
There was nothing Millet's crew prided themselves on more than the number of euphemisms they could offer for homosexuality.
Arse bandit, fairy fucker,
toilet trader. You want to thank God for the glass between us, boy?
Yeah. I thank Allah, yeah? I hope he fucks you up wicked, yeah? We're going to Bradford to sort out the likes of you, yeah, chief?
Halfway up platform 12, about to board a train they had no tickets for, a King's Cross security guy stopped Millet's crew to ask them a question.
You boys not looking for any trouble, are you?
The question was fair. Millet's crew looked like trouble. And, at the time, a crew that looked like trouble in this particular way had a name. They were of a breed. Ragastani. It was a new breed, just recently joining the ranks of the other street crews. Becks, B-boys, indie kids, wide boys, ravers, rude boys, acid heads, Sharons, Tracys, Kevs, Nation Brothers, Ragas, and Packies, manifesting itself as a kind of cultural mongrel of the last three categories. Ragastanis spoke a strange mix of Jamaican Patois, Bengali, Gujarati, and English. Their ethos, their manifesto, if it could be called that, was equally a hybrid thing. Allah featured, but more as a collective big brother than a supreme being, a hard-as-fuck geezer who would fight in their corner if necessary. Kung Fu and the works of Bruce Lee were also central to the philosophy. Added to this was a smattering of black power, as embodied by the album Fear of a Black Planet, Public Enemy. But mainly their mission was to put the invincible back in Indian, the badass back in Bengali, the P-funk back in Pakistani. People had fucked with Rajik back in the days when he was into chess and wore V-necks. People had fucked with Ranil when he sat at the back of the class and carefully copied all teachers' comments into his book. People had fucked with Dipesh and Hifan when they wore traditional dress in the playground. People had even fucked with Millet with his tight jeans and his white rock. But no one fucked with any of them anymore because they looked like trouble. They looked like trouble in stereo. Naturally, there was a uniform. They each dripped gold and wore bandanas, either wrapped around their foreheads or tied at the joint of an arm or leg. The trousers were enormous, swamping things, the left leg always inexplicably rolled up to the knee. The trainers were equally spectacular, with tongues so tall they obscured the entire ankle. Baseball caps were compulsory, low-slung and irremovable, and everything, everything, everything was Nike. Wherever the five of them went, the impression they left behind was of one gigantic swoosh, one huge mark of corporate approval. And they walked in a very particular way, the left side of their bodies assuming a kind of loose paralysis that needed carrying along by the right side, a kind of glorified, funky limp like the slow, padding movement that Yeats imagined for his rough millennial beast. 10 years early, while the happy acid heads danced through the summer of love, Millard's crew was slouching towards Bradford.
"No trouble, yeah?" said Millard to the security guy.
"Just going,"
began Hiffan.
"To Bradford," said Rajik.
"For business, yeah?"
explained Dipesh.
"See ya, bidayo,"
called Hiffan as they slipped into the train, gave him the finger, and shoved their asses up against the closing doors.
"Tax the window seat, yeah? Nice. I've blatantly got to have a fag in here, yeah? I'm fucking wired, yeah? This whole business, man. This fucking geezer, man. He's a fucking coconut. I'd like to fuck him up, yeah? Is he actually going to be there?"
All serious questions were always addressed to Millard, and Millard always answered the group as a whole.
"No way. He ain't going to be there. Just brother's going to be there. It's a fucking protest, you chief. Why is he going to go to a protest against himself?"
"I'm just saying," said Ranil, wounded.
"I'd fuck him up, yeah? If he was there, you know, dirty fucking book."
"It's a fucking insult," said Millard, spitting some gum against the window.
"We've taken it too long in this country. And now we're getting it from our own man, Rastlat. He's a fucking bado, white man's puppet."
"My uncle says he can't even spell,"
said a furious Hiffan, the most honestly religious of the lot.
"And he dares to talk about Allah."
"Allah'll fuck him up, yeah?"
cried Rajik, the least intelligent, who thought of God as some kind of cross between monkey magic and Bruce Willis.
"He'd kick him in the balls, dirty book."
"You read it?"
asked Ranil, as they whizzed past Finsbury Park. There was a general pause. Millard said,
"I haven't exactly read it exactly, but I know all about that shit, yeah?"
To be more precise, Millard hadn't read it. Millard knew nothing about the writer, nothing about the book, could not identify the book if it lay in a pile of other books, could not pick out the writer in a lineup of other writers. Irresistible, this lineup of offending writers. Socrates, Protagoras, Ovid and Juvenal, Radcliffe Hall, Boris Pasternak, D.H. Lawrence, Solzhenitsyn, Nabokov, all holding up their numbers for the mugshot, squinting in the flashbulb. But he knew other things. He knew that he, Millard, was a paki, no matter where he came from, that he smelt of curry, had no sexual identity, took other people's jobs, or had no job and bummed off the state, or gave all the jobs to his relatives, that he could be a dentist or a shop owner or a curry shifter, but not a footballer or a filmmaker, that he should go back to his own country or stay here and earn his bloody keep, that he worshipped elephants and wore turbans, that no one who looked like Millard or spoke like Millard or felt like Millard was ever on the news unless they had recently been murdered. In short, he knew he had no face in this country, no voice in this country, until the week before last, when suddenly people like Millard were on every channel and every radio and every newspaper, and they were angry. And Millard recognized the anger, thought it recognized him, and grabbed it with both hands.
"So you ain't read it?"
asked Ranil nervously.
"Look, you best believe I ain't buying that shit, man. No way, star."
"Me neither,"
said Hiffan.
"True star,"
said Rajik.
"Fucking nastiness,"
said Ranil.
1295, you know,"
said Dipesh.
"Besides,"
said Millard, with a tone of finality despite his high-rising terminals,
"you don't have to read shit to know that it's blasphemous. You get me?"
Back in Willesden, Samad Iqbal was expressing the very same sentiment loudly over the evening news.
I don't need to read it. The relevant passages have been photocopied for me.
Will someone remind my husband, said Alsana, speaking to the newsreader, that he does not even know what the bloody book is about, because the last thing he read was the bloody A to Z.
I'm going to ask you one more time to shut up so I can watch the news.
I can hear screaming, but it does not appear to be my voice.
Can you understand, woman? This is the most important thing to happen to us in this country, ever. It's crisis point. It's the tickle in the sneeze. It's big time.
Samad hit the volume button a few times with his thumb.
This woman, Moira, whatever her name is, she mumbles. Why is she reading news if she can't speak properly?
Moira, turned up suddenly in mid-sentence, said,
The writer denies blasphemy and argues that the book concerns the struggle between secular and religious views of life.
Samad snorted.
What struggle? I don't see any struggle. I get on perfectly okay. All gray cells in good condition. No emotional difficulties.
Alsana laughed bitterly.
My husband fights the Third World War every single bloody day in his head. So does everybody.
No, no, no! No struggle! What's he on about, eh? He can't wangle out of it by being rational. Rationality, most overrated Western virtue. Oh, no. Fact is, he is simply offensive. He has offended.
Look, Alsana cut in. When my little group get together, if we disagree about something, we can sort it out. Example, Mohana Hussain hates Divarjit Singh. Hates all his movies. Hates him with a passion. She likes that other fool with the eyelashes like a lady. But we compromise. Never once have I burned a single video of hers.
Hardly the same thing, Mrs. Iqbal. Hardly the same kettle with fish in it.
Oh, passions are running high at the Women's Committee. Shows how much Samad Iqbal knows. But I am not like Samad Iqbal. I restrain myself. I live. I let live.
It is not a matter of letting others live. It is a matter of protecting one's culture, shielding one's religion from abuse. Not that you'd know anything about that, naturally. Always too busy with this Hindi brain popcorn to pay any attention to your own culture.
My own culture? And what is that, please?
You're a Bengali. Act like one.
And what is a Bengali, husband? Please.
Get out of the way of the television and look it up.
Alsana took out Baltic Brain, number 3 of their 24-set Reader's Digest Encyclopedia, and read from the relevant section. The vast majority of Bangladesh's inhabitants are Bengalis, who are largely descended from Indo-Aryans, who began to migrate into the country from the West thousands of years ago, and who mixed within Bengal with indigenous groups of various racial stocks. Ethnic minorities include the Chakma and Mog, Mongoloid peoples who live in the Chittagong Hill Tracts district, the Santal, mainly descended from migrants from present-day India, and the Biharis, non-Bengali Muslims who migrated from India after the partition.
Oi, mister! Indo-Aryans! It looks like I am Western after all. Maybe I should listen to Tina Turner. Wear the itsy-bitsy leather skirts.
Bah! It just goes to show, said Alsana, revealing her English tongue.
You go back and back and back, and it's still easier to find the correct Hoover bag than to find one pure person, one pure faith on the globe.
Do you think anybody is English, really English?
It's a fairy tale.
You don't know what you're talking about. You're out of your depth.
Alsana held up the encyclopedia.
Oh, Samad Mia, you want to burn this too?
Look, I've no time to play right now. I'm trying to listen to a very important news story. serious goings-on in Bradford, so if you don't mind...
Oh, dear God!
Screamed Alsana, the smile leaving her face, falling to her knees in front of the television, tracing her finger past the burning book to the face she recognized, smiling up at her through light tubes, her pixelated second son beneath her picture-framed first.
What is he doing? Is he crazy? Who does he think he is? What on earth is he doing there? He's meant to be in school. Has the day come when the babies are burning the books, has it? I don't believe it.
Nothing to do with me. Tickle in the sneeze, Mrs. Iqbal, said Samad coolly, sitting back in his armchair. Tickle in the sneeze.
When Millat came home that evening, a great bonfire was raging in the back garden. All his secular stuff, 4 years' worth of cool, pre- and post-Ragistani, every album, every poster, special edition t-shirts, club flyers collected and preserved over 2 years, beautiful Air Max trainers, copies 20 to 75 of 2000 AD magazine, signed photo of Chuck D, impossibly rare copy of Slick Rick's Hey Young World, Catcher in the Rye, his guitar, Godfather 1 and 2, Mean Streets, Rumblefish, Dog Day Afternoon, and Shaft in Africa, all had been placed on the funeral pyre. Now a smoldering mound of ashes that was giving off fumes of plastic and paper, stinging the boy's eyes that were already filled with tears.
Everyone has to be taught a lesson, Alsana had said,
lighting the match with heavy heart some hours earlier.
Either everything is sacred, or nothing is. And if he starts burning other people's things, then he loses something sacred also. Everyone gets what's coming, sooner or later.
10th November, 1989. A wall was coming down. It was something to do with history. It was an historic occasion. No one really knew quite who had put it up or who was tearing it down or whether this was good, bad or something else. No one knew how tall it was, how long it was, or why people had died trying to cross it or whether they would stop dying in future. But it was educational all the same. As good an excuse for a get-together as any. It was a Thursday night. Alsana and Clara had cooked, and everybody was watching history on TV.
Who's for more rice?
Millat and Irie held out their plates, jostling for prime position.
What's happening now?
Asked Clara, rushing back to her seat with a bowl of Jamaican fried dumplings, from which Irie snatched three.
Same, man, Millat grumbled. Same, same, same. Dancing on the wall, smashing it with a hammer, whatever. I want to see what else is on, yeah?
Alsana snatched the remote and squeezed in between Clara and Archie.
Don't you dare, mister.
It's educational,
said Clara deliberately, her pad and paper on the armrest, waiting to leap into action at the suggestion of anything edifying.
It's the kind of thing we all should be watching.
Alsana nodded and waited for two awkward-shaped bhajis to go down the gullet.
That's what I tried to tell the boy. Big business. Tip-top historic occasion. When your own little Iqbals tuck at your trousers and ask you where you were when I say I was bored shitless watching it on TV.
Millat got a thwack round the head for shitless and another one for the impertinence of the sentiment. Irie, looking strangely like the crowd on top of the wall in her everyday garb of CND badges, graffiti-covered trousers and beaded hair, shook her head in saddened disbelief. She was that age. Whatever she said burst like genius into centuries of silence. Whatever she touched was the first stroke of its kind. Whatever she believed was not formed by faith, but carved from certainty. Whatever she thought was the first time such a thought had ever been thunk.
That's totally your problem, Mill. No interest in the outside world. I think this is amazing. They're all free. After all this time, don't you think that's amazing? that after years under the dark cloud of Eastern communism, they're coming into the light of Western democracy? United?
She said, quoting Newsnight faithfully.
I just think democracy is man's greatest invention.
Ulsana, who felt personally that Clara's child was becoming impossibly pompous these days, held up the head of a Jamaican fried fish in protest.
No, dearie, don't make that mistake. Potato peeler is man's greatest invention. That or pooper scoop?
What they want, said Millat, is to stop pissing around with this hammer business and just get some Semtex and blow the damn thing up. If they don't like it, you get me? Be quicker, innit?
Why do you talk like that?
Snapped Irie, devouring a dumpling.
That's not your voice. You sound ridiculous.
And you want to watch them dumplings, said Millat, patting his belly. Big ain't beautiful. Oh, get lost.
You know, murmured Archie, munching on a chicken wing. I'm not so sure that is such a good thing. I mean, you've got to remember, me and Samad, we were there. And believe me, there's a good reason to have it split in two. Divide and conquer, young lady.
Jesus Christ, Dad, what are you on?
He's not on anything, said Samad severely. You younger people forget why certain things were done. You forget their significance. We were there. Not all of us think fondly upon a united Germany. They were different times, young lady.
What's wrong with a load of people making some noise about their freedom? Look at them. Look at how happy they are.
Samad looked at the happy people dancing on the wall and felt contempt, and something more irritating underneath it that could have been jealousy.
It is not that I disagree with rebellious acts per se. It is simply that if you are to throw over an old order, you must be sure that you can offer something of substance to replace it. That is what Germany needs to understand. As an example, take my great-grandfather, Mangal Pandey.
Irie sighed the most eloquent sigh that had ever been sighed.
I'd rather not if it's all the same.
Irie, said Clara, because she felt she should.
Irie huffed and puffed.
Well, he goes on like he knows everything. Everything's always about him. And I'm trying to talk about now, today, Germany. I bet you, she said, turning to Samad, I know more about it than you do. Go on, try me. I've been studying it all term. Oh, and by the way, you weren't there. You and Dad left in 1945. They didn't do the wall until 1961.
Cold War, said Samad sourly, ignoring her. They don't talk about hot war anymore. The kind where men get killed. That's where I learnt about Europe. It cannot be found in books.
Oi, oi, said Archie, trying to diffuse a row. You do know Last of the Summer Wine's on in 10 minutes. BBC Two. Go on, persisted Irie, kneeling up and turning around to face Samad. Try me.
The gulf between books and experience, intoned Samad solemnly, is a lonely ocean.
Right. You two talk such a load of sh...
But Clara was too quick with a slap round the ear.
Irie!
Irie sat back down, not so much defeated as exasperated, and turned up the TV volume. The 28-mile-long scar, the ugliest symbol of a divided world, East and West, has no meaning anymore. Few people, including this reporter, thought to see it happen in their lifetimes. But last night, at the stroke of midnight, thousands lingering both sides of the wall gave a great roar and began to pour through checkpoints and to climb up and over it.
Foolishness! Massive immigration problem to follow, said Samad to the television, dipping a dumpling into some ketchup. You just can't let a million people into a rich country, recipe for disaster.
And who does he think he is? Mr. Churchill G?
Laughed Ulsana scornfully.
original White Cliffs Dover Pies and Mash Jelly Eels Royal Variety British Bulldog, eh?
Scar, said Clara, noting it down. That's the right word, isn't it?
Jesus Christ! Can't any of you understand the enormity of what's going on here? These are the last days of a regime. Political apocalypse, meltdown. It's an historic occasion.
So everyone keeps saying, said Archie, scouring the TV times.
But what about the Krypton factor, ITV?
That's always good, eh? It's on now.
And stop saying an historic, said Millat, irritated at all the poncy political talk. Why can't you just say A, like everybody else, man? Why do you always have to be so la-di-da? Oh, for fuck's sake!
She loved him, but he was impossible.
What possible fucking difference can it make?
Samad rose out of his seat.
Irie, this is my house, and you are still a guest. I won't have that language in it.
Fine, I'll take it to the streets with the rest of the proletariat.
That girl, tutted Alsana as her front door slammed. Swallowed an encyclopedia and a gutter at the same time.
Millat sucked his teeth at his mother. Don't you start, man. What's wrong with a encyclopedia? Why is everyone in this house always putting on fucking airs?
Samad pointed to the door.
Okay, mister. You don't speak to your mother like that. You, out, too.
I don't think, said Clara quietly, after Millat had stormed up to his room,
that we should discourage the kids from having an opinion. It's good that they're free thinkers.
Samad sneered.
And you would know what? You do a great deal of free thinking in the house all day, watching the television.
Excuse me?
With respect, the world is complex, Clara. If there's one thing these children need to understand, it is that one needs rules to survive it, not fancy.
He's right, you know, said Archie earnestly, ashing a fag in an empty curry bowl. Emotional matters, then, yes, that's your department.
Oh, women's work,
squealed Alsana through a mouthful of curry. Thank you so much, Archibald.
Archie struggled to continue.
But you can't beat experience, can you? I mean, you two, you're young women still, in a way, whereas we are like wells of experience the children can use, you know, when they feel the need. We're like encyclopedias. You just can't offer them what we can, in all fairness.
Alsana put her palm on Archie's forehead and stroked it lightly.
You fool. Don't you know you're left behind like carriage and horses? Like candle wax? Don't you know to them you're old and smelly like yesterday's fish and chip paper? I'll be agreeing with your daughter on one matter of importance.
Alsana stood up, following Clara, who had left at this final insult and marched tearfully into the kitchen.
You two gentlemen talk a great deal of the... you know what.
Left alone, Archie and Samad acknowledged the desertion of both families by a mutual rolling of eyes, wry smiles. They sat quietly for a moment, while Archie's thumb flicked adeptly through an historic occasion, a costume drama set in Jersey, two men trying to build a raft in 30 seconds, a studio debate on abortion, and back once more to an historic occasion. Click, 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 click.
Home? Pub? O'Connell's?
Archie was about to reach into his pocket for a shiny 10 pence when he realized there was no need.
O'Connell's? Said Archie.
O'Connell's,
said Samad.
10. The Root Canals of Mangal Pandey. Finally, O'Connell's. Inevitably, O'Connell's. simply because you could be without family in O'Connell's, without possessions or status, without past glory or future hope. You could walk through that door with nothing and be exactly the same as everybody else in there. It could be 1989 outside, or 1999, or 2009, and you could still be sitting at the counter in the V-neck you wore to your wedding in 1975, 1945, 1935. Nothing changes here. Things are only retold, remembered. That's why old men love it. It's all about time. Not just its stillness, but the pure, brazen amount of it. Quantity rather than quality. This is hard to explain. If only there was some equation, something like time spent here divided by time that I could have usefully spent elsewhere, multiplied by enjoyment, multiplied by masochism, equals reason why I am a regular. Something to rationalize, to explain why one would keep returning, like Freud's grandson with his Fort Da game, to the same miserable scenario. But time is what it comes down to. After you've spent a certain amount, invested so much of it in one place, your credit rating booms, and you feel like breaking the chronological bank. You feel like staying in the place until it pays you back all the time you gave it, even if it never will. And with the time spent, comes the knowledge, comes the history. It was at O'Connell's that Summerd had suggested Archie's remarriage, 1974. Under table 6, in a pool of his own vomit, Archie celebrated the birth of Irie, 1975. There is a stain on the corner of the pinball machine where Summerd first spilt civilian blood with a hefty right hook to a racist drunk, 1980. Archie was downstairs the night he watched his 50th birthday float up through fathoms of whiskey to meet him like an old shipwreck, 1977. And this is where they both came, New Year's Eve, 1989, neither the Iqbal nor Jones families having expressed a desire to enter the 90s in their company, happy to take advantage of Mickey's special New Year fry-up. £2.85 for 3 eggs, beans, 2 rounds of toast, mushrooms, and a generous slice of seasonal turkey. The seasonal turkey was a bonus. For Archie and Samad, it was really all about being the witness, being the expert. They came here because they knew this place. They knew it inside and out. And if you can't explain to your kid why glass will shatter at certain impacts but not others, if you can't understand how a balance can be struck between democratic secularism and religious belief within the same state, or you can't recall the circumstances in which Germany was divided, then it feels good. No, it feels great to know at least one particular place, one particular period from first-hand experience, eyewitness reports, to be the authority, to have time on your side, for once, for once. No better historians, no better experts in the world than Archie and Samad when it came to the post-war reconstruction and growth of O'Connell's pool house. 1952. Ali, Mickey's father, and his 3 brothers arrive at Dover with 30 old pounds and their father's gold pocket watch. All suffer from disfiguring skin condition. 1954 to 1963. Marriages, odd jobs of all varieties, births of Abdul Mickey, the 5 other Abduls, and their cousins. 1968. After working for 3 years as delivery boys in a Yugoslavian dry-cleaning outfit, Ali and his brothers have a small lump sum with which they set up a cab service called Ali's Cab Service. 1971. Cab venture a great success, but Ali is dissatisfied. He decides what he really wants to do is
serve food, make people happy, have some face-to-face conversations once in a while.
He buys the disused Irish pool house next to the defunct railway station on Finchley Road and sets about renovating it. 1972. In the Finchley Road, only Irish establishments do any real business. So despite his Middle Eastern background and the fact that he is opening a cafe and not a pool house, Ali decides to keep the original Irish name. He paints all the fittings orange and green, hangs pictures of racehorses, and registers his business name as Andrew O'Connell Yusuf. Out of respect, his brothers encourage him to hang fragments of the Quran on the wall, so that the hybrid business will be kindly looked upon. 13th May, 1973, O'Connell's opens for business. 2nd November, 1974. Summer and Archie stumble upon O'Connell's on their way home and pop in for a fry-up. 1975. Ali decides to carpet the walls to limit food stains. 1977. Samad wins 15 bob on fruit machine. 1979. Ali has a fatal heart attack due to cholesterol buildup around the heart. Ali's remaining family decide his death is a result of the unholy consumption of pork products. Pig is banned from the menu. 1980, momentous year. Abdul Mekki takes over O'Connell's, institutes underground gambling room to make up for the money lost on sausages. Two large pool tables are used, the death table and the life table. All those who want to play for money play on the death table. All those who object for religious reasons or because out of pocket play on the friendly life table. Scheme a great success. Samad and Archie play on the death table. December 1980. Archie gets highest ever recorded score on pinball, 51,998 points. 1981. Archie finds unwanted cutout of Viv Richards on Selfridge's shop floor and brings it to O'Connell's. Samad asks to have his great-grandfather Mangal Pandey's picture on the wall. Mekki refuses, claiming his eyes are too close together. 1982. Samad stops playing on the death table for religious reasons. Samad continues to petition for the picture's installation. 31st October, 1984. Archie wins £268.72 on the death table, buys beautiful new set of Pirelli tires for clapped-out car. New Year's Eve, 1989, 10:30 p.m. Samad finally persuades Mekki to hang portrait. Mekki still thinks it puts people off their food.
I still think it puts people off their food. And on New Year's Eve, I'm sorry, mate, no offense meant. Of course, my opinion's not the fucking word of God, as it were, but it's still my opinion.
Mekki attached a wire round the back of the cheap frame, gave the dusty glass a quick wipe down with his apron, and reluctantly place the portrait on its hook above the oven.
I mean, he's so bloody nasty looking, that moustache. He looks like a right nasty piece of work. And what's that earring about? He's not a queer, is he?
No, 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 it wasn't unusual then for men to wear jewellery.
Mekki was dubious, giving Samad the look he gave to people who claimed to have got no game of pinball for their 50p and came seeking a refund. He got out from behind the counter and took a look at the picture from this new angle.
What do you think, Arch?
Good, said Archie solidly. I think good. Please, I would consider it a great personal favor if you would allow it to stay.
Mekki tilted his head to one side and then the other.
As I said, I don't mean no offense or nothing. I just think he looks a bit bloody shady. Haven't you got another picture of him or something?
That is the only one that survives.
I would consider it a great personal favor. Very great.
Well,
ruminated Mickey, flipping an egg over.
You're being a regular, as it were. And you're going on about it so bloody much. I suppose we'll have to keep it. How about a public survey? What do you think, Denzel? Clarence?
Denzel and Clarence were sitting in the corner as ever. Their only concession to New Year's Eve, a few pieces of mangy tinsel hanging off Denzel's trilby, and a feathered kazoo sharing mouth space with Clarence's cigar.
Was that?
I said, what do you think of this bloke Summer wants up? It's his grandfather.
Great-grandfather,
corrected Samad.
You can't see me playing dominoes. You trying to deprive an old man of his pleasure? What picture?
Denzel grudgingly turned to look at it.
That? Oh, I don't like it. He looked like one of Satan's crew.
He a relative of you?
Squeaked Clarence to Samad in his woman's voice.
That explained much, my friend, much. He got some face like a donkey's pum-pum.
Denzel and Clarence exploded into their dirty laughter.
Enough to put my belly off its digesting, true sure.
There you are,
exclaimed Mickey, victorious, turning back to Samad.
Push the clientele off the food. That's what I said right off.
Assure me you are not going to listen to those two.
I don't know.
Mickey twisted and turned in front of his cooking. Hard thought always enlisted the involuntary help of his body.
I respect you and that, and you was mates with me dad, but no disrespect or nothing. You're getting a bit fucking long in the tooth, Samad, mate. Some of the younger customers might not...
What younger customers?
Demanded Samad, gesturing to Clarence and Denzel.
Yeah, point taken, but the customer's always right, if you get my drift.
Samad was genuinely hurt.
I am a customer. I am a customer. I have been coming to your establishment for 15 years, Mickey. A very long time, in any man's estimation.
Yeah, but it's the majority what counts, innit? On most other things, I defer, as it were, to your opinion. The lads call you the professor, and fair dues, it's not without cause. I'm a respecter of your judgment 6 days out of every 7. But bottom line is, if you're one captain, and the rest of the crew wants a bloody mutiny, well, you're fucked, aren't you?
Mickey sympathetically demonstrated the wisdom of this in his frying pan, showing how 12 mushrooms could force one mushroom over the edge and onto the floor. With the cackles of Denzel and Clarence still echoing in his ears, a current of anger worked its way through Samad and rose to his throat before he was able to stop it.
Give it to me!
He reached over the counter to where Mangal Pandey was hanging at a melancholy angle above the stove.
I should never have asked. It would be a dishonor. It would cast into ignominy the memory of Mangal Pandey to have him placed here in this irreligious house of shame.
You what?
Give it to me.
Now look, wait a minute.
Mickey and Archie reached out to stop him, but Samad, distressed and full of the humiliations of the decade, kept struggling to overcome Mickey's strong, blocking presence. They tussled for a bit. But then, Samad's body went limp and, covered in a light film of sweat, he surrendered.
Look, Samad.
And here Mickey touched Samad's shoulders with such affection that Samad thought he might weep.
I didn't realize it was such a bloody big deal for you. Let's start again. We leave the picture up for a week and see how it goes, right?
Thank you, my friend.
Samad pulled out a handkerchief and drew it over his forehead.
It is appreciated. It is appreciated.
Mickey gave him a conciliatory pat between the shoulder blades.
Fuck knows. I've heard enough about him over the years. We might as well have him up on the bloody wall. It's all the same to me, I suppose. Comme ci, comme ça, as the frogs say. I mean, bloody hell. Bloody hell. And that extra turkey requires hard cash, Archibald, my good man. The golden days of lunch and vouchers is over. Dear, oh dear, what a palaver over nothing.
Samad looked deep into his great-grandfather's eyes. They had been through this battle many times, Samad and Pandey. The battle